So it's a pleasure today to have as our speaker Giulia Rubino from the University of Vienna, and she will talk about time zero of a quantum superposition of thermodynamic evolutions.
So thanks, Flaminia. Yes, so with this talk I would like to tell you about this work on quantum thermodynamics that I did together with Czaslaw and also Gonzalo, and we put recently in the archive. And yeah, this deals with the time zero of a quantum superposition of thermodynamic evolutions. And in particular, when we discuss about time and about the time arrow, we always usually look at a system as a physical system, and we observe a change in this physical system. Now, if I want to ask you whether, for instance, I'm showing you the movie in the forward or in the backward direction, of course I have to pick a system in which the physical change is something that is not time symmetric. Otherwise, my question just doesn't make sense. I could be showing you the movie in the forward or in the backward direction, and there is no way to know. Of course, if I show you something like this movie instead, so a drop that ends in the ocean, for instance, then it's very easy to tell which one is the movie, the forward one, and which one is the time reversal. In the case of macroscopic system, then what happens is that basically there are some systems that don't allow you to define an arrow of time because they are intrinsic time symmetric. And there are some systems instead that they allow to define an arrow of time. But then because of the fact that actually it is a very well-defined arrow of time because there is a production of entropy, for instance, observing the time reversal of that, it's basically impossible. Like in this case, I would have to have a control over an infinite amount of degrees of freedom to make physically happen the time reversal of this movie. When we instead consider microscopic systems, then the situation is a little bit more delicate, because you can have, in fact, situations in which, even though it is possible to establish an arrow of time, for instance, according to the second law of thermodynamics, it is still possible to observe both either forward or a time reversal process. So as I was saying, there are many ways to define an arrow of time. But for instance, one could use the thermodynamic one that is in accordance to the second law of thermodynamics. So for the second law of thermodynamics, the total entropy of the universe can only either increase or remain constant. So you could use this, for instance, to given a physical system to define whether it's evolving in the forward or in the time reversal direction, okay? Now, as I was saying, in the case of microscopic systems, however, you can observe either of the two. And so basically the question that we asked ourselves was, okay, but given that I can observe either of the two, and given that quantum mechanics allow us also to create quantum superposition among orthogonal states, can we observe superposition of forward and back and backward time zeros? And what would it be the signature of this be? How would a well-defined arrow of time get re-established? So basically, these were the sort of questions that we were asking ourselves that motivated us to actually start to work on this project. And this is basically what I will now tell you with my talk. So in particular, just to give you a brief overview of what I want to talk about, I was just giving you now a quick motivation of what motivated us to do this. And then now I will start with providing you some background information on fluctuation theorems. This should help you to then understand all the results that I'm going to construct afterwards. And in particular, these results are going to be three main results. So there will be the fact that, as I was saying before, how does a well-defined arrow of time get reestablished? I will show you that upon measuring a variation in the entropy production, the system becomes effectively projected onto the forward or time reversal component in case you observe a variation of entropy that is either very large or it's basically very large in modulo, so either very large positively or very large negatively. Then I will show you also that instead, in the case of small entropy variations, the interference effects are to play an important role in defining the nature of this process. And then I will also apply all this more foundational concept to a more practical case of thermodynamic engines. And then I will just conclude and give some outlooks. So to present first the fluctuation theorems, I thought that using this example that I started with, actually it's a very, I think, handy way to present them. So let me define a little bit better the rule of the game that I was sort of playing at the beginning of this talk. So you saw at the beginning of the talk, I was playing some movies and I was saying, oh, which one is forward, which one is the backward. So suppose that I have a thermodynamic system to which I apply a thermodynamic quench and that I record it with the camera. And that suppose that I show you this movie. And of course, you are also provided information about the Hamiltonian of the system and also the change in the free energy of the system, okay? And suppose that I toss a coin and I decide, depending on the coin, whether I will show you the movie in the forward or in the time reversal direction. Now, how do you guess correctly? Now, in the case of a macroscopic system, as we were saying before, when we were looking at the drop, basically you can use the second law of thermodynamics. So you can simply see how it's the relation between the average work performed on the system and the free energy at the beginning and at the end of this thermodynamic quench. And depending on the sign of this, you will be able to tell me, okay, you are showing me the movie in the forward direction or you are showing me the movie in the time reversal direction. And you can always guess correctly if you use this method. In the case instead of a microscopic system, the situation is a little bit more complex because you should not just use the second law of thermodynamics, but you should actually take into account fluctuation theorems and also Bayesian probabilistic reasoning. So according to the fluctuation theorems, this is one of the main versions of fluctuation theorems, in a single shot of the movie, the probability of observing a positive entropy variation in the forward movie over the probability of observing minus W variation, so a work of minus W in the backward evolution, is given by E to the beta W this, where beta is the inverse temperature, and W this is the so-called dissipative work, which is defined as here, which was basically this quantity I was showing you before, the work minus the variation in free energy. So basically this tells us that total entropy decreasing events will vanish exponentially with the size of the entropy variation in the forward evolution, whereby entropy here, I mean the thermodynamic entropy, which is defined as this beta W this, so like this. I will also give later some more precise definitions also of the entropy. And in the case of the backward evolution, that formula tells us that total entropy increasing events vanish exponentially with the size of this entropy variation. So to maybe take an example to make this a little bit more concrete, suppose that I have a vessel and I have a gas inside this vessel with a piston, okay? And suppose that I say, okay, my forward quench is gonna be me pulling out the piston. Suppose that I pull it out very fast. So I had an initial equilibrium state in this vessel and with my gas in equilibrium and say half of the chamber, and then I pull the piston very fast outward. And at the beginning, the gas is still in its half of the vessel, but then it will thermalize occupying the whole vessel. The time reversal of this quench will be, of course, the opposite. So that the thermodynamic system was in equilibrium over the whole vessel, and then it will somehow spontaneously move to half of the vessel, and then I was pushing. Of course, if I was showing you this movie, for instance, you would say, and if I ask you which one of the two is the one that is with the highest probability occurred, you would say, oh, well, this one, the forward one, and this would be true. Same thing if I show you now if I swap and I speak now about what would be the time reversal of this. So if I'm still considering that pulling the piston outward is what we call forward, but in this case I'm actually pushing it in, then because of how I define what is forward, what is backward, I will actually have that, well, in one of the two cases, I'm pushing it in, and therefore the particles of my gas are being pushed inward. And so this is one is what is going to happen in the backward one. So it was at equilibrium, then I push, and then it gets equilibrium again. And in the forward one, instead, it would be basically the opposite of that. So if I was showing instead this movie, and I would tell you which one is the most probable, you would say, well, this one, which in this case is the one that is backward. So in one of the two cases, the forward one was the most probable, and in the other one, the backward one was the most probable. And this was exactly exemplifying this aspect of when I was telling you that depending on the size of the entropy variation, either entropy increasing event can become unlikely in the backward, or entropy decreasing event in the forward. Of course, this is applying to the case of a macroscopic system. So if I go to...
The temperature on the upper thing will be different in the two cases, right? Or the lower?
Well, the very first and the very last would always be should always be equilibrium states.
Right, but with respect to the previous slide, the temperatures are different.
Yes, yes. So the previous slide, this would be basically the most likely, and this would be not like the unlikely one. And still, the very first and the very last will be equilibrium states. And but in one of the two cases, actually, the quench I'm doing is pulling it outward, and this is just the time reversal of that quench.
Right, but in this slide, the upper temperature and the lower temperature are the same. In the next slide, the upper temperature and the lower temperature are different. Is that right?
I mean, I think that considering that, yeah, there will be less collisions. Yeah, one could say that there is a variation in the, yeah, there is a variation also in the free energy of the gas, I would say, yes. Okay.
Yeah, just to follow, I'm with you.
Can I ask a question as well?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just a bit unclear. On the last slide, the one before this one. The first one, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm accustomed to thinking about time reversal where you sort of don't have an agent who's intervening. And this example on the left, for example, we imagine somebody's pulling out the piston. Mm-hmm. Is the time reversal, so I can sort of understand the dynamics of the particles and how what the time reversal of that would look like, but how am I to imagine that the time reversal of an action, like pulling out the piston, am I to imagine that somebody's now pushing in the piston on the right-hand side?
Yes.
Okay, and then...
basically it would be time reversal in terms of, in one case you see the piston moving outwards, and in the other case you see the piston moving inwards. But yes, in this very case, I'm doing a different thing. In one case I'm pulling out, in one case I'm pushing in. And this is basically the time reversal quench, because I am applying two different driving mechanisms in my thermodynamic quench. So it's just that in one case I decided that I call this one the forward, and in the other case I call this one the backward. But I could also decide that for maybe my forward is just me pushing, for instance. Maybe this becomes slightly clearer now with the next slides. I can maybe show the next slides, and then if it's still not clear, we can discuss this very point again.
Okay, sure.
So what I wanted to say with this example, which actually refers to the macroscopic state, is that basically from these two examples, you can understand what I meant when I said that entropy increasing events are unlikely in the backward evolution and vice versa. And of course, you also understand that when I remove some of the particles and the system is less microscopic, they become increasingly more likely. So basically, in the case of fluctuation theorems, usually we say that if you consider this theta step function as being the case of a macroscopic system, you see that instead, in the case of a microscopic one, the situation is like, for instance, in this curve, where this curve shows the likelihood of the forward quench. And you can see that, you see here, there is this area which is blurred and basically shows you that there is there is a region in which you actually may observe either a forward or a time reversal. And instead, for very large values of the dissipative work, so very large sizes of the entropy variation, you may observe, you can tell actually with much more certainty whether your process is forward or backward. So maybe exact to make a remark about what we were saying before, I wanted to say that actually what I call backward and forward here are just labels, right? Like, for instance, in the case of the piston, I said, okay, let's say that pulling it outward is forward and pushing it inward is backward. Of course, I can also take the opposite. What is important is that one of the two is the time reversal of the other one, because in one case, I'm going to do one action, and in the other case, I'm going to do basically the time reversal of that. But then which one I label as forward and which one I label as backward is the same. So for instance, if I have a situation like where I have two energies and E2 is bigger than E1, if I decide that I call this forward, I will observe a positive entropy variation in the forward, in the so-called forward quench, and I will have this these laws. And instead, then I will have the backward, I will observe something that is a negative entropy variation. But I may as well define everything in terms of these tilde quantities that are referring to the time reversal case, where tilde W would be minus W. And then I would have that actually in this case, the tilde quantity variation of the entropy would be positive. So it really depends on which one I decide to call forward and which one I decide to call backward. And depending on that, then I will observe a positive entropy variation in the forward and a negative one in the time reversal, or vice versa. And the second remark maybe I should make also is that, as I was saying at the beginning of this talk, if I want to ask you whether something I'm showing you a movie and I'm asking you whether this movie is occurring in the forward or in the time reversal directions, I cannot do this in the case of a perfect time symmetric movie, because there would be no way to say whether I'm showing you any of the two, because they are just the same. So in order to consider the time's arrow, I need to consider situation where there is a lack of time symmetry. Otherwise, I would have that just in every single realization, delta S totally is equal to zero, and then it's impossible to assess whether this is forward or backward. And so there are many different ways to introduce the time asymmetry. And the way we decided to do it in our work is a very standard way, and is basically deciding to start always from some Gibbs state, from some thermal states. And so basically what we do is the following. We start from a thermal state, then we apply a thermodynamic quench. The thermodynamic quench brings my state out of equilibrium with this unitary that is defined here. And then my system, so for during this quench, my system is unconnected to the environment. Then I connect my system again to the environment, and it thermalizes with the environment, and it reaches another thermal state. Okay. The time reversal of this will be that I start from my thermal state, which was the final thermal state of the forward quench. I will apply a time reversal quench, and then it will thermalize to the initial state of the forward quench, basically. And the reason why I'm separating the evolution and this thermalization is so that I can isolate the work and the heat exchange, so that I can evaluate just the work. I can focus only on the work, and I can calculate the work. So basically, when I was saying, going back to this initial game in which I was saying I'm going to show you the movie either in the forward or in the backward direction, which one is the best strategy for a microscopic system? Basically, to summarize, the best strategy is that only in the case of observing a very big variation of beta and the dissipative work in modulo, then you can give a clear answer and say, okay, you were showing me the movie in the forward direction, or you were showing me the movie in the backward direction. Whereas there is a region of variations of entropy in which you cannot assess whether I'm showing you the movie in either of the two directions. And just the two are just as likely to occur. So this is pretty much all what I wanted to say about fluctuation theorems. And now basically I would like to use those fluctuation theorems for actually what we did in our scheme. So everything what I was saying until now, it's just related to a concept of just quantum thermodynamics, and then I will be applying now this concept to the framework that we've developed in our work. So for everything what follows, we will always consider that we have a thermodynamic system S, an environment E. This environment could include the thermal reservoir, but also other degrees of freedom that may get entangled with my system, and then an auxiliary system A. Just as a brief parenthesis, for those of you who are actually familiar with indefinite causality, and for instance, the quantum switch, this auxiliary system A would be somehow the equivalent of what is the control system in the case of the switch. The only reason why we decided to use it, to call it auxiliary system, is that because of a crash of terminology, there is already a use of the term control system that is the driving mechanism that controls the quench. But we will basically use this auxiliary system to create quantum superposition of forward and time reversal evolutions. So basically this will be my overall initial state. I will have that when my auxiliary system is in the state zero, then I will start in this initial state of the forward evolution. And when it's in the state one, then I will start from this initial state of the time reversal evolution. Okay. And what are these initial states that I'm showing you? So as I was saying, the system will start from some equilibrium states. And so here the beta was what I was saying before, the inverse temperature. Ek0 and Ek tau are the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian at time zero and tau. And Ek0 with the vector are gonna be the eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian. And instead, epsilon k0, epsilon k tau are gonna be the eigenstate of the environment, which can always be chosen as a set of orthogonal states. And also, as you can see, I forgot to say that the zeta zero and zeta tau are instead the partition functions of the system, and that this theta is the anti-unitary time reversal operator, which just basically flips the sign of observables with odd parity. And as you can see here, whenever I trace out my environment, I will obtain Gibbs states. So I will obtain some thermal states to start with, okay? So these are my two initial states that now I plug in that state I was showing you before. So this overall initial state. Then, as I was saying before, I'm gonna apply my quenches, okay? So when my auxiliary system is in the state zero, then I will apply a unitary U, which only acts on the system. So as I was saying before, during the quenches, the system is not interacting with the environment. I do the quench and then I plug it again to the environment. And so for now, during the duration of the quench, I'm gonna do a just identity to the environment and the auxiliary system. And then in the time reversal quench, I will have this when the state is one. And then at the end of the quench, I will connect again with the thermal reservoir. Okay, now because I want to calculate the variation in entropy, I need to introduce a possible way to calculate this, for instance, dissipative work, and so this changes in the energies at the beginning and at the end of the protocol. And so to do this, we basically did an extension of a standard technique that is called two-point measurement scheme. So just to remind you, what is the two-point measurement scheme? Basically, it is according to the two-point measurement scheme, work is defined as the energy difference between the initial and the final state before and after the thermodynamic quenches. And the application of this two-point measurement scheme has been shown also experimentally several times. And basically, the two-point measurement scheme allows us to compute the stochastic work that is invested in a single realization of, say, for instance, the forward process with this formula, where P and M is given by these formulas. And it's basically the probability of performing a measurement at the beginning at time zero and observing the eigenstate E and zero. And then you apply your unitary U. And then you perform another measurement at the end after the unitary, and you observe the eigenstate E M tau. And so this is basically this joint probability of P and M. And so this is this in the case of the forward process, and instead this W and M is defined as in here. So basically the same formula I was showing you before, where this is the stochastic entropy, which can also be shown to be equal to this amount. So the logarithms of the P and M for the forward evolution and P tilde and M for the time reversal evolution. And so it gives us basically a quantitative estimation of the distinguishability between forward and time reversal evolutions. And then in the case of the backward process, the two-point measurement scheme allows us to compute the stochastic work invested in a single realization of the backward process, where this W tilde is just minus W and M. So this is the so-called two-point measurement scheme, which is, as I was saying, a standard technique in quantum thermodynamics. And then what we did was basically we made an extension of this for our quantum superposition of thermodynamic processes. So what we did basically was we created this quantum superposition of forward and backward processes. And we did this, we performed this two-point measurement scheme inside our interferometric scheme. So we create the quantum superposition of this auxiliary system, and then we perform on one branch the forward process and in the other branch the backward process, as I was saying before, performing two measurements, one before and one after. Then we have again this, we close the interferometer, interfering again the two states of the auxiliary system, and then we measure it. So basically to perform this map, we do basically this. So we do that when the state of the auxiliary system is zero, we do identity on the environment, and then we perform a first measurement where we observe E and zero, then the unitary U, and then a second measurement E M tau, and this is instead for the case of the time reversal quench. Of course, one thing I must specify here is that all those measurements that I'm speaking about must preserve the coherence inside my interferometric setup. Because if I was just doing a measurement and observing the system, then I would just get, for instance, in that interferometer, just the which path information, and I would just erase any coherence between these two branches of the superposition. So what I instead should do is I should take an auxiliary system, which is large enough, so that I can encode each outcome of my measurement in a different state of my auxiliary system. And I keep all of them. I don't measure them right away. And then I interfere them at this second, on this second, what you say here is beam splitter, but whatever it is then in the case of bigger interferometers. And then you measure them afterwards. So you don't destroy the coherence within the interferometric setup. You just encode it in bigger auxiliary systems, and then you keep all of them, you interfere them again, and then you only measure afterwards. So in this scheme, I was showing you a beam splitter. So a beam splitter would only project on plus minus. But of course, I don't need to necessarily do just projection on plus minus. So what we consider was the generic case of a projection on the state psi for the auxiliary system. And so basically, this would be my final state at the end of my extended two-point measurement scheme. I had my initial state, then my map, and then I performed this projective measurement on the auxiliary system and identity on the system and the environment. And now we will look at the joint probability of measuring a certain work W, given that I had projected on the auxiliary state psi. Okay, just to clean a little bit the formulas that will come, I will define these few quantities. So psi of W given psi, that is just the conditional probability of W given psi. And then I will define just, I will just group these quantities in a Q0 psi and Q1 psi. So with these definitions here, then I obtain basically this final formula for the probability of observing an amount of work W given psi. Where, yeah, this first term corresponded to basically the amount of the probability of work which was associated, as I was showing you before, to the case of a forward evolution. And this was basically the case of the backward evolution. Whereas this is the part that corresponds to this interference term, which is basically given by this this long formula here. Now, we don't need to enter in the details of this specific formula, or what I want you to remember for what comes later is basically this exponential dependence on this e to the minus beta w alpha and the dissipative work. So just this basically. So as I was saying, in this part, in this formula, there is a first incoherent part, which is just compatible with running the process in one or the other time direction with a certain probability. And then there is the second part that is a sort of coherent part that is like the genuine quantum feature of my quantum superposition of temporal directions. Okay. So the first question I was, when I was starting and I was saying what I wanted to investigate with this quantum superposition of thermodynamic evolutions, one of the first things I said is, how do I observe that a well-defined arrow of time gets restored? And well, basically we observe that in case I observe this entropy variation and I observe a very large entropy variation, for instance, like here, then basically this CW given psi is roughly Q0 psi PW. So the state was effectively projected onto its forward component upon me having measured the a very large entropy variation. Vice versa, when I will have that for very small entropy variations, I will observe that instead, basically my system is effectively projected onto this time reversal component, where for the interference term, I use the fact that P and M tilde is equal to P and M e to the minus beta W this. So I just basically turn everything in terms of the tilde quantities. And so basically in this first part, I observed that whenever I do a measurement of the entropy variation and I observe very large entropy variation, either with positive sign or with a negative sign, I will observe that effectively I have projected my system either onto the forward on the time reversal variations. Instead, when I perform those measurements and I observe small entropy variations, these are the regions in which it becomes relevant, this interference term. And actually it plays a role in defining the nature of my thermodynamic process. So to just make you maybe a concrete example of what I mean with this, I'm gonna consider now a concrete example. So let's consider a spin 1/2 system that is supposed to subjected to a magnetic field, which is rotating within the xz plane at some constant angular velocity omega with this Hamiltonian. So basically it would be a situation like this, where you have a spin that at the beginning is in an eigenstate of sigma z, and then at the end will be in an eigenstate of sigma x at time t0 and time t tau. Now, as I was saying before, I'm gonna perform these quenches in the forward and in the time reversal manner, and I'm gonna superpose them in this extended two-point measurement scheme that I was presenting before. And then I'm gonna project the auxiliary system onto the basis plus minus, okay? So we then plot this histogram where we show the work probability distribution. So this P minus W and P plus W are the probability distribution in the case of having projected this auxiliary system in the state zero, in the state minus, or in the state plus. And this is in the case of a limit of a rapid quench. So I perform a quench very rapidly, and then the system has like it cannot like when I was pulling basically this piston outwards, the system doesn't follow it immediately, but then it will thermalize. So what I and this instead this PW plus PT tilde P minus W over two is the is gonna be the instead the classical mixture of forward and time reversal processes. So these ones. As you can see here, basically what happens is that this interference term can sharpen or flatten this coherent Bork distribution. So it effectively it either increases or decreases the degree of reversibility of this thermodynamic quench. Now, because in this very case, reversibility means adiabaticity, basically what happens is that in the post-electric case, I will have that I will observe the probability distribution of a slower quench than the one I effectively did, because as you can see here, as I'm showing you, the work is actually smaller than in the case of the classical mixture. And so basically you can use this method to obtain the probability of distribution of what would actually be a slower quench than the one you have implemented. So if you have, for instance, a system in your lab and you cannot slow down your quench actively because of maybe some limitations, you can use this technique to actually achieve in post-selection the corresponding probability distribution of a slower quench. And then finally, I also want to show you the application of this concepts that I was speaking until now to something that is not necessarily a superposition of forward and time reversal. Indeed, so far, I always use those concepts applied to the case of a forward and time reversal quenches, where by forward and time reversal, I was referring to the driving mechanism of my my quenches. But I don't need to. I don't need to necessarily consider a forward and a time reversal. I can also consider something else. So for instance, we can consider two thermal engines. So in our paper, for instance, we decided to consider a heat engine and a refrigerator. So basically the situation would be like this. So I have a cyclic swap engine with two qubits and two reservoirs. So we consider that we have a warmer and a colder reservoir. And then we perform a swap between the two systems that were at equilibrium with the reservoirs. So either I'm gonna transfer heat from the hot to the cold or vice versa from the cold to the hot. And in one case, the upper case, I will have a heat engine, the case in which I was transferring heat from one from the hot to the cold. And whenever instead I'm extracting heat from the cold, I have a power-driven refrigerator. In this case, basically, we do, again, all the things I was showing you before. So we put these two different thermodynamic engines in this two-point extended two-point measurement scheme that I was presenting before. And we obtain this probability joint probability distribution of having performed a work W and absorbing a certain heat QC. So these two are the just the standard quantum thermodynamical probability distribution of a heat engine and a refrigerator. And so as you can see here, this is the probability of extracting a certain amount of work W while dumping heat in my cold system. This is the probability that just nothing happens. I don't extract nor invest work, nor do I release heat or extract heat. And this one instead is the situation of the refrigerator. So this is the peak in which I extract, I have to invest work to extract heat and so refrigerate my system. So what defines basically what is the heat engine and the refrigerator is the case that here you have a higher peak for the case of the heat engine, so extracting the work. And instead here you have a higher peak for the refrigerator, so having refrigerated your cold system. But as you can see, in both these two standard quantum thermodynamic engines, basically the highest peak is at the center where there is just nothing happening. When you plug these two machines into this extended two-point measurement scheme, there is a case in post-selection in which basically minus, in which the probability of machine doing just nothing is basically lowered down and minimized. And so you create this quantum superposition, and if you consider it in post-selection, the machine will basically always do something. Will sometimes be a refrigerator, sometimes be a heat engine, but it will always do one of the two, basically. And so you can use this technique to reduce unwanted thermodynamic fluctuations in your system. And so basically with this, I sort of told you everything what I wanted to say. So just to basically summarize what I'd said until now was that I had asked some questions at the very beginning when I said, if I create this superposition of a forward and a time reversal quenches, how does a definite thermodynamic arrow emerge in this superposition? And what I was showing you is that this emerges upon measuring large entropy variations. So when I observe a large increase or decrease in the dissipative work, I will have an effective projection of the system onto its forward or backward temporal directions. And then I also asked the question of what is the signature of the interference between a forward and a backward processes. And I showed you that instead, when I perform those measurements of the dissipative work and I actually observe small values, these are the cases in which this interference terms become relevant. And I showed you, for instance, then superposing in this extended two-point measurement scheme to processes that are, for instance, irreversible can result in the dynamics of a process that is no longer irreversible or less irreversible, perhaps, and depending on the cases. And that I also showed you that those techniques do not necessarily need to be applied to the case of a forward and a time reversal quench, but can also be applied to different situations. And for instance, I applied it to the case of a heat engine and a refrigerator. And I showed you that this could be used to limit the unwanted fluctuations in the performances of these thermal machines. And concerning future directions, well, this was the first work along this line. So we are considering now how to move next. And of course, one obvious thing could be to more on a practical side to search if there is any machine that could do something more useful. Because, well, in the case of the machine I was showing, the machine will always do something, but sometimes it will warm up and sometimes it will refrigerate. So you cannot really choose if you want to warm up your meal or cool it down. And in the other case, another interesting thing to do, maybe on a more foundational side and less applicative, would be to instead maybe trying to apply these findings to other sort of entropies, for instance, the coarse grain entropy. So basically this is it. And this is a list of references for these slides.
Okay, Julia, thank you for this interesting talk. So we can thank Julia. And so we can take questions. I think Carlo is first.
I'm mute. Yeah, I think I'm unmuted there. Very fascinating, Julia, thank you. I mean, it's just very stimulating, a lot of points which raise thinking. I just want to see if I've understood correctly and check that. And also, there's one point which I'm. Let me see if I understand. The first thing you're saying is that if you have a big macroscopic system, there are certain processes which are possible, others which are not possible. We know very well. But of course, when you go to a smaller one, we see that the impossible processes happen, of course, because we're away from the macroscopic limit. It's just the notion itself.
They happen provided that the variation of entropy is still within a certain limit. So also in the microscopic case, if it's too big, still they...
Right. But yeah. Right.
Yes.
So it's,
yes.
It seems there are things with the... Now, you're calling this backward evolution in time in some sense. So to some extent, this is just naming.
Yeah, this was what I agree. Yeah, this was what
this happened in nature. We do understand that irreversibility it's a limit thing, and therefore reverse thing happens. So that's what you call bar. And then you say, good, great, let's see what happened if we study superpositions of the two. You can put
Well, you can pick either of the two and call it forward, but the other one will be the time reversal of that. So and fluctuation theorems show that, you know, whenever, like at the very beginning of my talk, I was saying, if I show you a movie and everything is just perfectly time symmetrical and there is no entropy variation in every single run, then it doesn't make sense to say which one is forward, which one is backward. But the point of this, instead, for instance, fluctuation theorems, is that there is an entropy variation. So it's not that the entropy variation is just zero at every single run and they are just perfectly time symmetric, but there is an entropy variation, and this nevertheless, you can observe either of the two. And then it's, of course, it's arbitrary whether you want to call this one forward and this one backward or vice versa. But whatever you pick as the forward, the other one is going to be its time reversal. And they are both possible in the microscopic case for certain variations of entropy.
Right. So, but in a lab, you have a big macroscopic world around with a very precise direction in which entropy increases.
Yeah. But I isolate my system. Yeah. Exactly. Indeed. But
you're using that because then
during the quench, I isolate my system.
Exactly. Because in the actual description of what you're saying of your lab experiment, you're using a logic in which there's a before, a preparation, something happened, and then so you're using the you have an external, clear, unquestioned direction of time and direction of entropy. And then you isolate your system, and it's small enough so you can play with both. Good. So I understand this part. Now, in your picture, if you go back, there was this wavy yellow thing at the end, which said, and then there's a thermalization time there. There was also a wavy one at the beginning. Which
this
you
one,
didn't
no?
mention. No, before. No, when you actually...
Yeah, this and this. There were...
Not this one.
Ah,
this
you, one mean, you mean...
In the apparatus, the full apparatus.
Yes. I know which one. I just have to find it.
Just went to...
This one.
Yes. You said thermalization on the right.
Yeah. The system already starts. No. So I actually maybe the drawing is confusing because it appears like after the beam splitter. But as I was saying before, I have to start and to end in states which are at thermal equilibrium. So as I was showing you also in this drawing of this quench and then thermalization and then quench and thermalization, I have to start and end in thermal states because otherwise I would have that there is just that they are just perfectly time symmetric. So the thing is that it starts at equilibrium, then I apply the quench. During this quench, it's unconnected to the reservoir. Okay, so I'm only applying my quench to my system. And then I connect it again and it thermalizes. Now, what happens is that I apply a unitary to my system. So my unitary brings it out of equilibrium. But of course, if it was only up until now, this would be perfectly time symmetric because if I was not reconnecting my system to the external environment, this would just be able to, it's a unitary. So it brings it out of equilibrium, meaning that because we define equilibrium as a thermodynamic system in which there are no fluxes exchanging. And so the reason why it brings it out of equilibrium is that at the beginning it was at equilibrium and now I did a unitary and now there are fluxes exchanging in the system. But it up until now, as long as I don't reconnect it to the environment, it's fine. Like it could totally be reversible. I could reverse it because I only need to have a control over my system to reverse my unitary. And this is perfectly reversible. Then I connect it again to the reservoir. It thermalizes and now it becomes irreversible because I would need to have a control over an infinite amount of degrees of freedom in order to reverse this.
Yeah, I think I get the logic. Let me get to the question because of these two things. Suppose I want to stare at this picture and I am Hugh Price. I don't believe that there is any early and later in the universe, a preferred direction of time. The only direction of time is given by by entropy in the macroscopic world in which I am. Mm-hmm. Can I look at this picture all together? Can I read it the other way around, from right to left?
Yeah, of course. So you just
all these thermalizations are actually time oriented by themselves. So I'm assuming that there is in that thermalization, what is happening on these wavy lines, there's a jump toward up of the entropy toward the right and not toward the left. What is going on?
Yeah, but okay, maybe I'm not understanding your question. Yes, I mean, when I said I called this forward and I called this backward, and then I'm just putting one in the forward and in the backward. Of course, if I flip everything around, it's just like swapping the names. I can flip everything and do this two-point measurement scheme in the other direction.
No, don't flip.
This is the question.
The history of the world described by entropy. This is an actual realization of this in reality in a lab, okay? Mm-hmm. Now I'm God, I'm looking from outside, I'm looking at it, and I say, oh, on these wavy lines, I can compute the change of entropy and it goes up this way. Is that true?
Yes, in the single one, there will be an entropy variation that will be positive depending on how you set the initial and final
In the actual lab, not depending on anything. Am I right or wrong in saying that delta S on the wavy line just itself goes up toward the right? This is an actual measurement done in the lab for real. Or am I wrong?
I'm not sure, but I think you're wrong.
yeah, that's a question. I would like to be wrong. I would love to be wrong.
I think you are going too far, and I think what you are referring to is time reversibility that of your work and also Lucian talk. But here we not attack now discussing this question.
The whole
experiment can be seen as a time reversal. There is something interesting even before we come to your question, and that's here you have a superposition of two processes with opposing thermodynamical errors of time. So it doesn't matter which one you call forward, but which backward, as Julia said. But when you get some value of the entropy change, this value will be only preferable for one of the two processes. So it's really opposing thermodynamical errors of time. So one can say, well, then it's not really well defined. But of course, the whole process is done in experiment with some preparation and so on. And on this overall scale, we can then discuss, is it still time reversal or not? But you know, direction is not even on that level well defined.
No, I understand that inside the actual what you consider the running of experiment itself, you it makes sense to say in some sense you can say this if I want to read out the direction of time from the increase of entropy, it is in both. I'm superposition. I'm doing superposition two directions. I get that. I was trying to push it farther a bit. Okay, thank you.
So there are questions from Rob and Rob. I think Rob Speckens was first, and then Rob Mann.
Hi Julia. I have a question just about how you didn't say much about how you preserve the coherence, given that the processes you're trying to superpose are exchanging energy. Like, for example, the clearest case would be the superposition of a heat engine process in a refrigerator. So one of those is consuming work and the other you extract work from. So if I imagine that I had like a weight in a gravitational field, which was my work source and work reservoir, one of those processes would, you know, lift the weight, that'd be the heat engine, and the other process would, the weight would drop. That would be the consumption of work to make the refrigerator work. So if you just did it that way, the state of the weight in the gravitational field would have information about which of the two processes would done. And so you couldn't have coherence between them. So I was just wondering if you, I mean, I have some notion of how you could get around this, but yet, did I miss it in your talk? Have you addressed that question?
Well, not in the specific case that you were discussing. So, I mean, I was considering more the, I mean, for instance, just in the case of an interferometer and this case of these two measurements, and I was saying that you can encode them in bigger, in more states of this auxiliary system. But I have not specifically considered this case of, for instance, that you were mentioning. So your question is, if in one of the two cases I invest a certain amount of work, and in the other cases I'm extracting a certain amount of work, and these are two macroscopically distinct states, doesn't this action collapse my superposition? This is your question, in a sense.
Yeah, that if you treat the work reservoir as a quantum system itself.
So maybe one could have, I mean, I think, I mean, we actually discussed this point in our paper in the supplementary part, and we showed that that actually if my control system is large enough, so it's spread enough, and you can consider that the two situations in which you invest work and in which you extract work are actually not macroscopically indistinguishable, and that you can consider them as within this standard deviation of your system, not as two macroscopically distinct states, then you can just somehow consider your superposition of system and ancilla and your control driving mechanism as just two separable things, in which one of the two is basically remaining in the same state before and after because of the spreadness of the state that doesn't change much from being basically spread in the initial state of before, for instance, investing or extracting work and afterwards.
I see. So if I understand correctly, this is what I was expecting, that you have a kind of work reservoir which is initially superposed over a number of different energy eigenstates in such a way that if the energy that I'm extracting or depositing in it is small compared to that spread, then you can set it up so that the overlap between these two
it's
states
still very large,
are still large.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that answers my question. Thanks.
Sure.
And the other Rob.
Yeah, hi. Am I unmuted? So, thanks. Very interesting talk. I sort of had a related question to the previous Rob. You're coupling systems together at one point where you can either put work in or put work out. But I could imagine doing this for any conserved quantity, momentum or angular momentum and so on. And would it make sense to carry out this procedure there? And do you expect analogous results? Let's say you have a spin system and one spins up and the other spins down, or vice versa. Then I could imagine keeping the energy fixed, but it's the angular momentum that goes back and forth. It seems to me that similar things should carry through.
Say so. I mean, I never thought about this aspect, but I at the first guess, I would say so, yeah.
Okay, all right, that's about what I would think. And the other thing I wondered, a bit more speculative, is whether one could apply this idea to chaotic phenomena, where you have a system that two things near initial conditions, they wildly deviate. So I could imagine in this picture I'm looking at, starting from one system going somewhere else at the other end, maybe I've got a system that's epsilon close, but its final state is very different. Would it make sense to apply this formalism there? The final initial aren't perfectly symmetric, but nevertheless, there is a kind of a time's arrow in a chaotic system, right?
I think, as I was saying before, they don't even need to be necessarily the time symmetric of one another. Like in only in the first two parts, I was showing you this this quenches that whose driving force was one of the time reversal of the other. So one can in principle also decide to superpose different things. And then of course, one only observes something significant from this interference part when these entropy changes are relatively small, so they are not extremely large. So if in such a chaotic system you would observe that the entropy change is extremely large, then probably you would not observe any particular signature of the fact that you created a superposition of the two. But aside from this, I think, yeah, you could superpose them. It's just whether or not you would observe then a phenomenon depends on.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. It's not clear to me if it would. I mean, in quantum chaotic systems, you can get tunneling between islands of stability. And so in some sense, after a long time, right, the system develops, there's chaotic sea surrounded by stability islands, and you get tunneling between them. And so I guess I was thinking in terms of the end thing with the oven and the fridge, you get... You can tune things if you project, if I remember, on psi minus, was that right? Or the minus?
Plus and minus, yeah, because it was projecting on this auxiliary system.
Yeah, one was bad, but the other was good.
Yeah.
Good. So yes, I guess I could imagine maybe something, not that I've thought a lot about this, but something similar in a quantum chaotic system where you could maybe either enhance tunneling between stability islands or suppress them. But it's not obvious. I mean, it will, you know, maybe it can't work and the entropy factor you say will just kill it all, but maybe not. I don't know. That's just an idea. I didn't know if it had any, if you wondered if you thought it had any merit.
I haven't thought about it, to be honest. And well, my first time. My first answer would be I would just look at the entropy change of this, and I would say, well, if it's too large, either in positive or negative sign, then there is no chance to actually hope to see something. But I haven't thought of this specific case that you are mentioning, so I cannot give you any more detailed.
Are there more questions? Yeah.
That you had to me?
Yes. Sorry, this is not clear. Any
questions? Sorry.
Rob first and then Carlo?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm wondering if you could try to summarize for me what you see as the conceptual implications. So let me frame my question. I mean, this pattern of studying, you know, quantum superpositions, you know, that you can do that in a lot of cases. So you can talk about a superposition of different causal orders, for example, and use similar mathematics. And then I guess, you know, one of the conclusions there would be something like the notion of a well-defined causal order is not fundamental in quantum theory. It's something that emerges in the classical limit. So I'm just curious, like in this context, what do you think the lesson for thermodynamics is? Like, are there thermodynamic concepts which this shows are not applicable in quantum theory and should only emerge in a classical limit? Or how would you summarize the overall lesson of studying coherent superpositions of forward time and backward time thermodynamic processes?
Well, Well, the thing is, in the case of a microscopic systems, already the fluctuation theorems show some non-null probabilities of observing forward and time reversal. And what we tried was to try to see whether it could be, for instance, that there are quantum superposition of forward and time reversal processes in nature. And then whenever you try to actually observe them, you are not able to, because you are just trying to look, just by trying to look at them, you are actually collapsing them into, like, you are actually observing, in fact, a forward or a time reversal quench, because you have observed a very large or a very small entropy variation. So this was, I think, the very original idea of why this we started to study this, like, what would happen? Could it be that there are there? And whenever we try to observe them, because we observe this large entropy variation, we actually don't see this. And in what way could we actually observe such a thing? So this was sort of the original idea and the original implications that we were trying to find from this study. So this would be basically my personal first answer, but this would be basically my conclusions. And then, of course, I think one could totally create connections with the case of indefinite causality. But the situation there, like, then it's... The thing is that still, when you observe then a very large positive or entropy or negative entropy variation, you observe that, well, the times are always well-defined. So any other conclusions of a non-well-defined Tamsaro could only be in a limited region of these entropy variations. So I think that the conclusions that one could draw in this very specific case would be a bit more detailed and less somehow on a broad scale, because still, when the entropy variations are very large, all those things are not observable, and actually there is a very well-defined arrow of time. So this would be basically my answer, but I wonder if Czeslaw would say anything different from what I said.
Not much. I would say we created, a superposition that without the concept of measurement has not well-defined arrow of time. And then the arrow of time is, so to say, emerges in the process of measurement, maybe because we usually look at the entropy changes. This is the basis what we choose by looking at thermodynamical processes. And in this basis, we effectively then project on one or the other instant, one or the other time error. And one can even think maybe that, this is not speculation, that maybe environment measures in this space is such that even if there were some processes that will start to create this superposition, they are always suppressed. And we have this kind of impression of the continuous time directionality. And of course, then the most interesting case is exactly when you have these interferences, which is kind of on the top of our classical ignorance about the time error with the classical fluctuations. There is really some interference effects that even can kind of trick us to think that something is more or less reversible due to interference than any of these components in the interference. But this is something which I actually less understand. But again, more or less what Julia said, that's the lesson for me as well. Maybe Gonzalo, who is also here, has a certain opinion.
I agree with what you said, and Julia. So it's essentially, for me, this shows that these superpositions are compatible with macroscopic thermodynamic laws. And that when you go to the microscopic origin, then you can either have these superpositions or one or the two, and then there is a difference between having a superposition and having a normal quench, either in one direction or in the other. Yeah. Yeah, then the questions are maybe if this can be used for something, or but on the fundamental level, I think it's the compatibility of laws of thermodynamics and quantum mechanics. So
great, thanks. Carlo,
do you want to ask?
I wanted to take the discussion exactly in the direction that sort of Rob took it and Czaslaw and Julia, in fact, developed, namely on the larger conceptual implications or expectations on that. So let me sharpen a specific question to Julia and just a piece of that, of the big discussion. We do have a strong intuition that so the universe is moving from past to future, this passage of time. The terminology that you use strongly suggests that you are sort of exploring the view that this is just it has a thermodynamical origin. So this is just an effect, this distinction between past and future of the fact that there's a direction in which entropy grows. And so my question is, can I interpret your terminology in that sense? Because that's what your terminology strongly implies. And for full disclosure, that's exactly what I strongly believe, that this is the case. I know that there are people who disagree with that, namely that the full phenomenology of the difference between past and future of the wonder of the arrow of time is thermodynamical in the larger sense, I mean, just large sense of losing information, increasing entropy, large definition of entropy. It's only originated from that, nothing else, which means that a fundamental formulation of physics, where of course thermodynamics is only true in some approximation, some limit. It's super general, but it's only true in some limit, can do without, and can do without the difference between the past and the future. And of course, in quantum mechanics, we usually work with laboratory measurements, which heavily rely on entropy growth because of use of the environment, the coherence, and everything. So in the core of quantum mechanics, we constantly exploit in the use of it the fact that there is a good entropy gradient in the universe to which we can hang. But your terminology, I mean, just calling time reversal the fact back in time, simply the fact that entropy goes down, seems to go exactly the same direction. And then what you're doing is indeed, I would interpret indeed in a ontological sense, superposing back and forward the going of time, because it's not philosophy, it's physics, because I believe the physics teaches us that everything we connect, we interpret as a time arrow is nothing else than things which are rooted, phenomena which are rooted in entropy growth. That's my opinion, but I wanted to know how do you see this, and because you seem to go in the same direction.
Okay, so because the question was very long, I just maybe wanted to specify that, for instance, I read your work together with Andrea Di Biagio, and also last week I heard the talk of Lucian and all these topics of this lack of like this complete time symmetric of
fundamental.
Yes, and I don't know if I see, for instance, a very clear link between these things that, I mean, of course, this work does not contradict that work or anything like this, but I also would not see that it is necessarily going in the same direction. So if this was sort of the main point of your question, but
yeah. I mean, why do you call time backward in time if it's just going ahead?
No. I mean, I'm not. Down. Yes. No. I agree on. I mean, on that aspect, I agree. We are trying to superpose two opposing arrow of times. But whether or not then the long term direction is to actually prove a sort of lack of a well-defined on a global scale arrow of time, I would not say that this is our goal, especially because I would not know how to do this in a more operational way, perhaps. But I don't think that this was the goal. Personally, I would say that this was not the goal. I mean, at least this is mine, not mine. But and I don't see that, as I said, I don't think that this contradicts those results, but also it doesn't necessarily aim to go in that specific direction. But there is no contradiction, of course, between the two results.
If I say something, so I think that here the words forward and time reverse are referred to the quenches, no, the unitary quenches. Essentially, the one quench follows a specific change in the Hamiltonian of the system. So it's a kind of a external protocol which is implemented. And in the time reverse, it's just the time reverse version of that protocol. And this is what, for me, introduced here the notion of forward or time reverse. So it's just that you are kind of externally applying a protocol on the Hamiltonian, and then you reverse it. So in...
But Gonzalo, why don't you present? I can follow you there, this, I understand what you mean, but why you then you presented this big words and say, well, I have superposition between pushing and pulling.
Yeah, well, this is just a macroscopic example of what changing the Hamiltonian will look like, right? It's how you perform externally this protocol, how you change externally the Hamiltonian according to some protocol, no? Just you pull a piston or you push. So it's for me, it's the same concept. So in the quantum case, you may be thinking you just have two energetic levels and then you modulate in a linear ramp, for instance, and then in your forward protocol, you increase the energy difference between these two levels, and in the backward one, you decrease it. But there you are already introducing a notion of time, right?
Okay, Chaslo, is this a comment on this?
No, I leave the, I mean, it's a comment more on Carlos' original question.
Okay, because we have one. Well, actually.
Yes. Sure. No. I don't want to interfere. Yeah.
No, I don't know. If it's a short comment, maybe you can.
No. Go, please. No.
Okay. So, Steve.
Yeah. Hi. I actually have a question rather than a monologue. Can you go back to the diagram you had up before with the whole process laid out?
Mm-hmm. Yes. This one?
Yeah, okay. So what I don't, this may be just a, verging on a dumb question, but you have thermalization at each end of those things. This is related to something that Carlo brought up in his first question. Is this supposed to be a unitary evolution?
This is a unitary evolution. This is a unitary evolution. This is unitary. This is unitary. And then during that part, I'm not connecting to the environment, and I'm only performing a unitary on my system. And that part is indeed what I was saying, is the reversible part. And then I connect it to the system, and that part is the non-unitary one.
I see. So you're evolving the first part from the, for instance, going left to right, you have the preparation of the beam splitter, and then it thermalizes. And then...
Yeah, actually, the thermalization would be all over. Like, it would start from a thermal state all over. Yeah. Yes. it is a thermal state over here. This is thermalized.
Right, right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Then I perform this
involving a some sort of mixture. Right?
I'm involving some sort of mixture. If
you thermalize a pure state, I mean, you're not going to get a pure state. Right? This is what I'm asking anyway. I can see that you have a unitary evolution in the middle.
Ah, yes. I mean, okay, yes, of course. Meaning that I have my system, I thermalize it to the environment, then I separate the environment. So I would basically start from this sort of mixture because I've traced out my environment, and then I would do my unitary, and then I would thermalize it again. Yes. Right.
Okay, so why would the two boxes on the left, the one above the other, why would they be different?
The boxes on the left, this and this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why aren't those the same state? Why couldn't they be the same?
They could be. I mean, I think the point is that when I was showing you before this, when I was showing you about these two thermalizations, I was saying that, well, in one case, you start from a thermal state, you perform your unitary, and then it thermalizes in a sort of final state that is a thermal state as well, but it's not necessarily the same. And the other one, it starts from a different thermal state. So this state is thermal, and this state is thermal, but they are not necessarily the same state. So this and the other initial state, they are not necessarily the same state. And so over here,
mm-hmm.
these two initial states, they're not the same necessarily. I mean,
you mean zero and one?
Zero and one are the state of the auxiliary. And I mean the corresponding states of the system here and here. Yes.
Yeah.
So what I was showing in this equation, let me. What I was showing you here,
uh-huh.
these were these two initial states of the forward and the backward processes. And they were different. So in light of this, then this two may give different results because they are applied to different states, initial states.
Okay. Let me think about that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. Sure. I think we have time for one last question by Ding.
Hi, everybody. This was intended to be a comment on Carlos' comments in that direction, but in the interest of time, I'll turn it into a short question. So in Julia's, your answer to Carlos' comment, you said your goal of your project isn't it along that direction. So may I ask, what exactly is the goal of this project?
Well, this was sort of also the question of Rob Speckens. I mean, I think that this was sort of the answer. So, basically, we wanted to try to see, like, what if there are processes over there in nature that are actually superpositions of forward and time reversal. How would we see them? Would it happen that we are trying to observe them, and actually we would in the end end up even though originally it was a quantum superposition of forward and time reversal, then when I try to observe it, I am actually in the end, because I'm observing a very large entropy variation.
I see. This ties up actually to my comment on Carlos' comment.
Okay.
So it seems to me more reasonable to put in, you know, the agencies, the things that observe into the picture as a physical system. You know, we have memories, and you know, our perception is based on memories, and then it gives us in some loose sense a direction of time, and then maybe you can try, you know, put these physical systems into the use or near the use and see what happens. I mean, right now at this level of discussion, I see that the agencies are outside of the whole picture you're showing. It's like we're doing a preparation on the left, and then we're doing observation on the right. It seemed to me it would be interesting to, you know, put in the physical observers and then discuss the memories and see actually whether it's possible at all to put the arrows in superposition when we have actual physical agencies. That's my comment.
Okay, thank you. Czaslaw, do you want to say something?
Yeah, just short. I mean, I think if we exclude any fundamental irreversibility in nature, then it seems like what Carlo was saying, that this irreversibility can be through kind of entropy concept, that we basically maybe ignore some element, some degrees of freedom, and we see apparent directionality of time. Now, what we wanted to do with this is even to weaken this and say, wow, look, what if we now have a superposition of opposing thermodynamic errors on time? How then to see any directionality of time? And then I think that's the element Dink also said now, is that maybe observation is a very important element of that, and observation of entropy is something which then effectively projects onto a definite time error. Of course, there is no agency in a sense of choosing different measurement apparata, which is usually what we in interventions, but rather observation of an entropy instead of observation of some other quantity is what then project this superposition to definite time error. Thanks.
Thank you. So I think we had a very lively discussion, and so thank you everybody for participating so actively, and thank you Julie again for giving the talk.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak about it.
And so let's thank the speaker and everybody else again.